You're listening to the Food Talk Show, produced by Channel Radio. It's the Food Talk Show with me, Paul Andrews, and the lovely Sue Nelson. Good afternoon, Sue. How are you?
Yep, I'm good. I'm good. How are you?
I'm okay, thanks. Yeah.
We've just had Valentine's Day a couple of days ago.
We have. How exciting was that?
Are you...
Not.
Just pulled a terrible face. Are you a romantic person?
Not anymore, no.
Not anymore?
No.
Have you ever been a romantic person?
When I was married, I was really good, I think. I think she was spoilt rotten. And
do you?
It just didn't work out.
So what sort of things? Are you sort of by flowers or food?
I was saying this to someone the other day. I don't know if I was trying to hit on them or not, trying to impress them. But I was saying that I wasn't a big deal for Valentine's Day per se, but I always bought my wife flowers every week. At some point during the week.
I don't know why. That just makes me laugh. I don't know why. I don't know. I just can't imagine.
That's funny. That's what she said too.
I can't imagine you trotting down to wherever it is to buy a bunch of
daffodils. Garage.
Yeah, garage.
The Shell service station. Yeah. No, I bought a decent flower. Yeah. So,
Did you ever buy aphrodisiac at all? Aphrodisiacs? Trying to woo your wife or other girlfriends with food?
No.
No? Oh, I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah,
I
said no. I suppose you know the old oysters and all that is one of those oysters and champagne and what have you. Yeah, I suppose.
Have you?
Yeah.
Well, I've got a list of some aphrodisiacs you might want to use next year, just in case. You know,
well,
get
I don't
romantic.
Know anyone.
You might by then. You've got a year to get around to it. An aphrodisiac is supposed to be saffron. You know, saffron that you put in curries. You know, really expensive. Have you got some?
I got gold saffron. Do you remember? We met a lady.
We had that lovely lady, didn't we?
We met that really gorgeous lady that was importing saffron from Iran.
That's right.
Yeah, and she gave me some.
Well, apparently, you could smother your, should we call them paramour? You could smother your paramour with saffron and sit back. And apparently, if you just wait, they'll then swoon at your feet.
Really?
Yeah. It's just what you need, isn't it, I think. Yeah. Obviously, it costs a lot, though. I mean, that's the only thing.
It is expensive, isn't it?
It's a bit more expensive than chocolates and carnations, probably. But, I mean, 100 grams would set you back about £300. Could be worth it.
Could be. Do you know, funnily enough, on the Bunker Show, which is a business show we do earlier in the week, which actually fell on Valentine's Day this year, on the 14th of February, we had the Donington Manor Hotel contacted us while we were on air and said they were offering aphrodisiac workshops.
I don't even know what that means.
And I have no idea what that involves even.
Shall I tell you about caterpillar fungus? There is a caterpillar fungus that's also an aphrodisiac.
Caterpillar fungus?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. And it's a bit of a grizzly fungus. So it looks not very nice. It's also known as Yartsa gunbu.
Well, it would be.
Yeah, of course. And
who's it known by?
Not me. And it likes to burrow into the body of an unfortunate caterpillar host. And ultimately, it kills it by exploding through its head.
That's got to be an aphrodisiac, hasn't it? I'm going to burrow into you and explode your head.
So, but apparently the actual caterpillar fungus is literally natural Viagra. So... That's a thought, isn't it? Shall I move on to the next one?
No, I'm still trying to get my head around that. Who told you this?
It's been thoroughly researched by our researchers on the show.
Is it scientifically proven?
Okay. Oh, yes. Ambergris?
Oh, I've heard of ambergris. That's the stuff you scrape off whale teeth or something, isn't it? Or something like that, isn't it?
yeah, that's a pretty good snapshot. And basically, it's produced when the whale's stomach is irritated by something, foreign object or something.
Yes.
And this sort of grey, sticky stuff comes up, so to speak. And essentially, they used to use it a long time ago as well in history, where they'd use it to perfume egg dishes and stuff like that. Mm. And reputedly, it's a favourite of King Charles II.
Really?
He was called the Merry Monarch.
And he was a bit of a fop, he was, wasn't
he? We know why now.
Yeah, he was well out of there. Yeah.
And then there's the sea cucumber. That's another aphrodisiac. So it's like, unfortunately, it's a bit of a slug-like thing. So
I was going to say,
not very good at wooing.
It makes it sound like it's some kind of vegetable, but it actually isn't, is it?
No, it's an unappealing echinoderm. Thought you'd like to know that. And it's got a very robust immune system. So actually, it makes it quite a sought-after sort of treatment for everything from healing wounds to reducing blood pressure. Mm. But it's the sea cucumber's libido-enhancing properties that, that are sought after in the aphrodisiac mould.
One of the problems with a lot of these aphrodisiacs is,
horrible, aren't they?
Is the ancients had a tendency to think something was an aphrodisiac just because of the shape of it.
Possibly.
You know,
I think we'll move on.
Some kind of phallic representation. Mm. And they go, oh, that must make you horny.
Or something.
It's horn-shaped.
No, yes. I am definitely going to move on now. So that was Valentine's Day. And that's just my top tips for you, Paul, for next year.
Well, thank you. Help. It's a bit late now, isn't it? You should have told me on Tuesday.
I should have done,
No wonder my Valentine's was such a write-off. Anyway.
Must have been. Yeah. So let's get back to this programme today. We have got three lovely, lovely guests. A bit boy today, though. A bit boy. No, we've got no girls today, apart from me. But we've got Robert Hocking, who's in the studio with us, from Independence Market. Got loads of things I want to talk to him about.
Sure.
And then Nigel Lloyd from the Soft Butter Company. And butter's sort of coming a little bit back into fashion, actually, after being slated for quite a while. So,
well, funnily enough, I've started eating butter again for the first time in years.
I've never stopped eating butter. I love butter.
I went for years without eating butter. I'm a martyr to my weight.
Your health.
I stopped eating butter a long, long time ago, but I like butter. And then all of a sudden, the scientific community went, oops.
It's okay.
Sorry, we made a mistake. Mm-mm. So I've gone a bit mad recently, and I've been sautéing me mushrooms and stuff in butter.
Well, we can certainly talk to Nigel about that. And Robert actually used to be in that sector, so he's probably got a few things to say.
Okay.
And then towards the end of the programme, we're going to be talking to Steve Keller.
Right.
And he's an expert on music and food.
Music and
food. And the relationship between different types of music and how it affects your taste.
Really?
You might pick up some tips there. You've got loads to learn today.
That's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty interesting. So we'll be talking to him later on.
Is that things like that? There was a thing a while back where the supermarkets were experimenting with playing different types of music in their stores that increased the purchase rate of various things.
He didn't talk about that directly, but what he was talking about was actually chocolate and how different, you know, sorts of music could affect your taste of chocolate and all sorts of other things. And he's been sponsored by Cadbury's to do some work.
I thought you meant like Errol Brown.
No.
Hot chocolate. No.
Not hot chocolate. But really interesting.
Okay.
So before we sort of, I think we'll talk to Nigel first. Before we talk to Nigel, should we have a little bit of music?
Yeah, I've got some cheesy tunage just for Valentine's Day. What do you reckon?
I don't really like Valentine's Day.
Well,
it's about love then, isn't it? It's not going to be about sea cucumbers and aphrodisiacs.
It's not about sea cucumbers. There's quite a lot in this song, but I don't think they ever get round to mentioning sea cucumbers.
No, it's quite an old one, this song.
It is.
I think this came out when I was at school.
All right, you're trying to be funny now. Yeah.
It's 10cc, isn't it?
It is. I'm not in love. Well, should we have a bit of a listen to it?
Just because I call you up.
Heard that for ages and ages and ages and ages, probably a decade, I think.
It's been quite a while since I haven't played it for a long time. I know that. Mm. So
I'm going to be talking about Butter now. Oh,
are you?
Yeah, and we're going to be speaking to Nigel Lloyd of the Soft Butter Company. But I want to give you some statistics about Butter.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, Butter was demonised for health issues some time ago, and you certainly gave butter up, didn't you, for a little while?
It was a long time I went without butter.
And there was an NHS report last year, though,
mm-hmm.
that found eating 14 grams a day of butter, so that's about a tablespoon,
right,
had little to no effect on overall risk of death.
Really?
Yeah.
Blimey.
Or heart disease or stroke.
Right, okay.
That's not really what the sort of health people were saying before, was it?
No, it wasn't. They were saying the opposite, actually,
yeah,
weren't they?
Yeah. And actually, they have been saying, the NHS, that butter even seems to protect very, very slightly against diabetes.
Oh, okay.
And in 2014, the average consumption of butter was 40 grams per person per week. And obviously, I really hate margarine. Absolutely hate margarine. And I'm actually really glad that butter's back in. So I use butter quite a lot. I try not to use too much, but I use butter quite a lot. And margarine, for sure, is the devil, I think. It's been linked to lower IQ levels in children, and goodness knows what's in it. So I'm not very keen on that. So softer butter is what it's all about. We're going to talk to Nigel in a minute. But before we do, Robert, you know a little bit about butter. You used to work in that sort of category. Have you got any thoughts about it coming back into fashion?
As a matter of fact, yes, I used to work for a big company that owns Flora. And in fact, my job was to try and counter the butter people. In fact, butter was the enemy to us.
Butter was the enemy?
Yeah, of course, because we were selling against them and trying to convince consumers that all that animal fat was bad for you and all of our palm oil was better for you.
Yeah, so, and palm oil obviously is, so many people are really upset about palm oil and not keen on palm oil at all because of the deforestation issues.
Yeah, of course.
But at one time it literally was seen as a really good thing because it was a cheap way of making some of that stuff. So
yeah, but the butter guys always were winning the battle because it had more of an all-natural kind of aura to it.
Yeah. So
hopefully we've got Nigel on the phone now. We lost the line, sorry.
Nigel, are you there?
Hi.
You've come back to see me. Oh, hi there. Just tell me a little bit. Yes. Just tell me a little bit about the Soft Butter Company, because we all love our butter, but actually when I get my lovely hot toast, I need it to be spreadable. And I know you've been working very hard to get this very naturally soft butter. How have you managed to do that? It's a closely guarded secret.
It's taking us about 2 years of hard work, lots of trials, lots of failures on the way. It's a difficult product to make because, as you know, butter can sometimes be very firm when it's taken out of the fridge. And it was, the idea originally came to me driven by my wife, who was driven crazy by the fact that she would take butter out of the fridge and was the knife often was bending as she was trying to spread it.
Yeah.
So what we did, we using natural butter, it is actually possible to select the very softest butter fat components within the butter. And that's essentially what we do. We take the very softest butters and we use that into our products. So there's no vegetable oil. There's nothing in there. It is pure butter.
Because there's a lot of spreadable butter on the market already, isn't there? Is that, has that just got lots of things added to it? Is that how they've made it spreadable? Is that what you're saying? And you're trying to find one where you can make it naturally butter that naturally spreads?
Well, I think the consumer trends are showing quite clearly that people are moving away from spreads. Now, in the UK, Europe, and many parts of the world, if you add anything to butter, for example, vegetable oil, you can no longer legally call it butter. So I think there is a lot of confusion about the aisle when you walk in the supermarkets and have a look at the huge range of products. But essentially, if you turn over and have a look on the ingredients, if the product has oil or emulsifiers or any of that added to it, legally you can't call it butter. So there are very strict regulations protecting butter, and it's there for good reason. So the consumer, they love the flavor of butter. They see it as a natural product, and they have a problem, a convenience problem. When they take it out of the fridge, it can be quite difficult to use. So many of the spreads that you would see in the aisle are not actually butters. Mixed fat spreads.
Yeah.
So some of them may have a butter element within them, but many of them would be what I would call a margarine. So there's no butter in there at all. It'd be a mixture of water and vegetable-based oil.
So Nigel, explain to me how you actually make butter normally. It's milk, isn't it?
Well, the source product if you were making it at home,
you'd get some...
You take the cream.
Yep.
So if I'll give you an example. You could go into your local supermarket, buy some cream, put it into a sealed beaker, and if you shake it vigorously for a couple of minutes, it will naturally turn into butter. So what you have there is the butter fat will separate from what we call the liquid fraction, which is buttermilk. You can drain the buttermilk off, and you can drink that. It's got protein in it, and it tastes very nice. And if you wanted, you could, the remaining butter, you can wash that in cold water. You could add some lemon juice or put some salt on it, and you could use that as normal butter. It's as simple and easy
and
as that.
And that's the natural process that's been done for hundreds and hundreds of years.
I'm putting myself out of a job here, aren't I?
No, not at all. Because most of us haven't got time to do
it. It won't be softer.
No, but what I'm saying is that
it
that's
won't
the
be
natural
naturally softer like our butter.
Yeah,
if you take it out of the fridge, it will be quite hard. But it's as simple as that, really. It's a natural
So that's the natural process. What you've done is presumably taken very specific types of milk or whatever it might be to try and get the softest natural version of that you can.
The problem with this is that Nigel quite clearly isn't going to tell us how he does it, because that's part of his USP.
He's obviously not going to tell us the closely guarded secret. What I'm trying to get is, in general, that's what you've been trying to look for. How do I take this natural process and this natural product and find the best elements of it that I can that will make it soft, as opposed to adding stuff to make it soft?
Yes, I mean, you wouldn't be able to do that in the kitchen, but you can make butter.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you make it out of cream, and cream comes, of course, from milk. Many of the spreads that you would see on the aisle, you'd have a significant amount of water and vegetable oil in there. Mm. And if you try to vigorously shake those, you would be there for a week.
For quite a long time.
And you will not turn it into a physical product. And that's why you need emulsifiers, stabilizers, and many other sort of chemical products really into that process, using very sophisticated industrial process to make that into what it is.
To spread, yes. Now, I know that you've got people who are obviously working on this expert blend. You call them, is that right? You call them butter beauticians?
Beauticians, I saw that, yeah.
Right?
I love it.
And they expertly blend and gently massage their secret butter formula.
That's right. I mean, I suppose what we wanted to do from the outset was to have a fun and kind of funky product, because we thought there'd been a real lack of innovation in the butter aisle. And you've got very sort of corporate brands there. So we wanted to bring a sense of fun to it. And, you know, butter should be a fun product. Many people use it in their bakery products and, you know, have a cook with their children. And, you know, you can have a lot of fun with butter. So, yeah, it was a sense of humor really behind that.
No, that's a really good idea. And I think I like that. And I think it explains, I suppose, your thinking and what you're trying to do. Now, I've been on your website, and you've been sort of teased people on your website about this Closed Garden Secrets and where you can find out about it, but you actually can't, can you? Because you're not telling anybody, are you?
Well, I've got to be very careful with what we divulge on that. I mean, first of all, of course, if our competitors knew, then, you know, we are...
You'd have to kill us all, wouldn't you? You would, Nigel. You'd have to come around and kill us all if we gave it away.
Well, we're a small company, and, we put a lot of work into this, and it would be so easy to go out there and trumpet and then everybody copy it. So
of
course. We don't want that.
No, you're absolutely right.
We are going to apply for a patent for the process that we got. So it would invalidate the patent, so yes. I've been told
not to say a word.
Yes.
So
sorry.
No, that's all right.
If anybody wants to find out about it, it's the softbutterco.co.uk, and I believe you can buy it in supermarkets now. Is that right, Nigel?
Yeah, we're in just over 160 Morrison stores. If you live in Wales, you'll be able to buy it in most of the Tesco stores, and we are talking to a number of other supermarkets at the moment about gaining listings.
Well, there's
quite a lot of excitement about it. I mean, the product has done tremendously well since it's gone into the stores where it has. So, you know, it's got a fantastic flavour, and we've sent samples off to Camden Research Association. They have certified that it's at least 50% softer than the many standard butters on the shelf, so you should be able to take it out of the fridge and spread it and enjoy it on your crumpets, your toast, or whatever.
So at the moment, if anybody's listening and they're interested in the soft butter, they need to trot down to Morrison's, but I'm guessing it's going to be practically in every supermarket fairly soon, I would think. Wouldn't you? Thank you very much for joining us, Nigel.
And you're welcome.
That's really interesting. I'm going to see if I can... There's a Morrison's near me. I might go and nip down and have a try.
Absolutely. Yeah, I like a bit of soft butter. Yeah. Nigel, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. And we wish you much and continued success with your soft butter product.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye now.
Robert, what do you think of that, having been in the sort of category? It's pretty difficult one to crack, isn't it? It's a bit of a holy grail, isn't it, that people are after?
The thing is, if we're talking about 50% softer than hard butter, it's not that soft. I'd be curious to try it, for sure. Mm. I'm a butter fan.
That's a really mean thing to say, Robert.
Well, it's just an immediate thing.
It's half
listen,
a soft.
I'm like a consumer.
It's
I am
half
a consumer.
A soft. It means you'd be able to spread it, surely. I'm going to try it.
Yes, it only rips your bread partially.
But
he's a real meanie, isn't he?
Yeah, no, but I have spreadable butter of the type that Nigel was saying isn't butter because
it isn't really.
Yeah, no. And even that's hard. I made a slice of toast this morning and I got it out of the fridge. And it wasn't that soft.
Got to come up with a new definition for soft, I think.
Yeah, possibly.
Anyway, let's talk about you, Robert. I'm going to talk, first of all, you're very involved in the food sector, but I'm going to talk to you first about the independence market.
Yes, indeed.
And Paul gets very, very upset if we're in the studio and there's no food. And obviously we've had Nigel on the phone, so we didn't have any spreadable butter there. But right in front of me, his little eyes lit up. Because
I'm so excited
about
this.
Some Moroccan meatballs that I have to say look incredible.
They look fabulous,
and,
don't they?
What's this to go with it? Is it some couscous? Or?
Yeah, it's giant couscous with some herbs and black olive.
A little bit of orange in there as well, I think I can see.
Yeah, that's right. That's it's not orange, it's actually apricots.
Ah, and there's some... Look at that, Paul.
I think you guys
gorgeous.
Are going to like that.
Is that pomegranate?
Pomegranate seeds in there.
Yeah, some seeds to sprinkle to finish off.
Very nice indeed. And this is actually what your company does. It looks like I've made it myself. I'm quite fussy about food, and it really does look like it's something that I've made myself. And essentially what Independence Market do is you develop high quality... I don't actually like to use the word ready meals because they're not... It's like you've cooked them for me and just brought them along. I suppose that is a ready meal, isn't it? But in my head, ready meals are like plastic.
Yes, I know. Yeah.
And literally, they take minutes to prepare, and you they're seasonal. They're available 5 days a week. And you can sort of choose the menu. I think that's how it works. I'm going to ask you about that.
Sure.
I'm going to give you an example, Paul, of the typical weekly menu from Independence Market. On Monday, you could have salmon ginger teriyaki with bok choy and coconut pilaf. That could just arrive at your house. Tuesday, you could have sizzling...
Sorry, do you send me this?
Yes.
We're going to ask Robert in a minute.
All right, sorry.
On Tuesday, you could have...
Because I'm liking this already, and we've only got to Monday.
Tuesday, sizzling Singapore noodles with chicken. Wednesday, pineapple and mustard glazed pork with mash and greens. Oh, yummy, yum. Thursday, Moroccan lamb meatballs, which we've got here. Friday, art box DIY pizza.
Sorry, you lost me there. Is that in Klingon? What was that again?
No idea. So Robert, tell us how it works. Tell us all about it.
So I actually spent about 25 years working as a brand and retail strategist. So I'd had the great benefit of being able to talk to a lot of consumers, literally thousands of consumers over the course of my career. And I suppose I just got to a point where I began to lose faith in some of the clients that I was working with. And so originally, I suppose this journey started back in 2007, where I resigned from a job. I was managing director of a company, and I spent 6 months researching the food industry. And at that point in my career, I'd spent a lot of time working with some pretty big food brands. And it's one of the things that brought me here, actually. I've come here, France, U.S., Canada, doing research. And I eventually, I kind of came to understand that the typical grocery retail model just is broken, in my view. It's a model that hasn't changed very much. And when you talk to people about, particularly in Independence Market, it is really a retail business that's aimed at mums. When you talk about a mum and her daily needs, there's one question that gets asked every day in family households, and it's, what's for dinner tonight? And the typical mum is poorly equipped to actually come up with a new solution. And, you know, 73% of families eat the same thing every week, and half of families make two meals every night. And most people today, believe it or not, don't have a big repertoire of recipes. Mm. So it's a real issue. And I just thought, you know, there is a better way to feed people. And so the menu that we've designed is one that is built with families in mind. We crowdsourced what family favorites were, and then we built on that. And so they're all basically...
By crowdsourcing, you mean you went out and did some market research and got some feedback about what people were really...
What were
really
people eating?
Actually truly feed their families.
Because it was quite interesting. As you were reading the menu to me, I thought, oh, that's a... Yep. So clearly the research has highlighted that these dishes are the kind of things that people enjoy to eat.
You've got loads of dishes, though, haven't you, Robert?
Yeah, so this isn't what a consumer would necessarily see, but we've built the menu to basically allow you to either be involved not at all in preparing the meal or involved somewhat in preparing the meal. And that really is just accommodating people as to how much time they've got. Mm. The other side of it is we've created a list of menu items that are what we call core items, like a fish pie, or what we call stretch or reward items. Because we know through the research that people's habits in terms of what they want to eat changes through the week. Mm. And so something like the Art Box DIY pizza is essentially entertainment and dinner in one, because you get a raw dough, you get all the ingredients to top a pizza, and it's great. Kids love it because they get their hands into it.
Okay, so it's a make-your-own pizza box. Okay, cool.
Art box, you see? You create a piece of art.
It's
important to get kids involved in preparing food,
of course,
isn't it?
Yeah, and we're developing something right now that's specifically aimed at getting the kids cooking.
Yeah.
So where do you operate, and how do people order your
So food? Right, we launched 2.5 weeks ago. We invested heavily in using data to understand where to land this, and we launched formally. Our soft launch is in Putney, Wimbledon, southwest London, but we are very, very geographically focused. So we have got a list of postal codes, and we'll be marching through those postal codes. You know, hopefully helping families eat, and not just food, but we also offer other things but food. But that's really our focus: simplify people's lives.
So. Can I ask, Robert, so how does this work? Are you sending, you deliver this, or
yeah.
people?
So yeah. What happens is, if you were registered with our site, you'd wake up in the morning, you get a notification from us that says basically, good morning, here's what's for dinner, and you have a chance to basically choose an item, choose a time slot, and the quantity that you want, and basically our driver shows up and right. drops it off.
Okay.
So it's like a car, though, but your dinner's ready.
Yeah, exactly. Correct, yeah.
Yeah, you should use that in the marketing. That was quite cool, that.
If you do say so yourself.
A cardo, but it's ready.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's ready to eat now.
Yeah.
And so you're saying that regardless of how you want to get involved with what you choose, either you leave it up to you or you know, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
It still gets to you, it gets to the table inside 30 minutes. However, you know, how it's prepared, all you have to do is literally spend not much time at all in getting
everything
it ready.
That we make in theory can be to the table in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
So when we did a ton of research with mums. So one of the things is there's a huge psychological thing with mums in terms of feeding their families. And if someone was making dinner for them every night, it takes away all sense of their own ownership and pride. But the reality is today, families are so busy, mums are so busy, that some nights they have no time, which means they want literally something that can stick in the oven or a microwave. And some nights they want to have a hand in it. And it gives them that some of our dishes are tailored that way, that you literally do, like we're your sous chef, but you do the final preparation.
Right.
Yeah.
So it gives you flexibility.
Yeah, and I think especially when the kids are a little bit older, you know, one's at hockey practice and one's got to be picked up from here and then somebody's doing this, and, you know, and then you've got all the washing to do and then this happens. Sometimes you just think, literally, oh my goodness, I've got 20 minutes and that's the only window I've got to sort all this food out for everybody, you know.
I'm telling you
right
now.
And it's difficult, isn't it?
You know, the typical, I'm Gen X, typical Gen X mum knows on average about 4 recipes. Typical millennial mum knows on average 0 recipes.
Does that include beans on toast?
Okay, I'll give you that one. Probably everybody knows that one.
Yeah.
But the reality is that most family households are run by women. 94% yeah. of households in this country are run by women.
Yeah.
And it falls to them to put dinner on the table.
Yeah.
And so if you don't know how to cook, I mean, this is the remarkable thing. 73% of families eat the same thing every week. Mm. And when that happens, your kids and your husband are going, oh, chicken again? What? Well, you know, I need something.
73%.
73%.
So like Monday, it's this. Tuesday,
yeah, exactly. Because
almost.
they know it works. And they
right.
don't want to waste money on something their family won't eat.
All time.
The other thing is about half of those families make 2 meals every night. And, you know, so if you imagine that. Somebody wakes up in the morning, they get the same question asked, what's for dinner tonight? They don't really know how to cook. They're trying to keep it interesting. And then suddenly they're faced with trying to deliver a meal to the table.
Mm.
And the reality is a typical grocery store, if you look at the model, I can show you a picture of a Tesco store from 1950 and a Tesco store today. They're identical.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. So you're faced with ingredients you don't know how to use or ready meals, which for the most part are made with they're just not great products. I mean, they're certainly not products I'd feed my own family.
No.
Horse meat lasagna, etc. Yeah.
Well, nobody wants to do that if they can get, you know, if they don't have to, I think. But have you got the skills or the time or the equipment not to dish up a horrible ready meal? That's what you're saying. And some people don't have the
Correct.
Skills to do that.
For sure. They don't have the skills or they don't have the time.
Yeah.
So Robert, can I ask you, you've got a meal here in front of me, which is Moroccan meatballs and couscous with a fabulous looking layout. If I order that from you and you deliver it, what do I do once you've delivered it?
Well, that particular dish, it varies according to the dish, but
right.
they're all pretty simple. The packaging, which unfortunately listeners can't see, the packaging comes from a French company, and those containers are made out of wood.
I was going to say, it looks like bamboo.
Yeah, it's not bamboo, actually. I'm not entirely sure what the wood is, but it's a very soft wood.
It's very light.
And the amazing thing about that packaging is it's good up to 260 degrees in the oven, it's good in the microwave, and you can freeze with it.
Right.
So when I was looking at various services out there, one thing that really struck me was the amount of packaging, the plastic, and I just couldn't deal with it.
Yeah, sure.
So the great thing about that is it's you know, we use it to start fires in our fireplace afterwards.
Yeah.
You know, and it's definitely more environmentally friendly than what's out there.
Yeah.
The other thing for me is, you know, when it says on these things, you know, for four, well, not in our house, it's not.
Right.
Because often for four is like what we'd have for one person.
Yeah.
This is pretty damn chunky. That is for four people.
Yes, and I will tell you something. We spent a lot of time on this. like I, you know, I do many of the deliveries myself because I want to talk to people.
You want to get
and
the feedback.
We have upsized our portions. Yeah. We upsized that the size of those meatballs on the basis of getting feedback. This is so vitally important today. I mean, the thing is, as a business person, it's so hard to earn a quid today that if you're not totally tuned into what people need, my job is to deliver to them. And I completely agree. That's the problem with a lot of ready meals is they're undersized for what people eat.
Right.
And we've really been careful to make sure. So next meal I'll bring
it. So it's a shame that people can't see it because it's really lovely.
It looks great.
It's really well presented in the wooden boxes and the food itself looks gorgeous. So that meal in front of me, how many is that designated
that's
for?
That's for four
people.
Yeah. I know you'll eat it all on your own, Paul, but that's
I was going to say, I'm a bit of a pig and I eat a lot of food.
You couldn't eat all that though.
But I would struggle to eat all of that in one sitting.
And in terms of how have you managed to, you know, you've done lots of research, but how have you managed to work out that the sorts of things that people would like to eat, bearing in mind that the things I've read out are obviously a bit more of your exotic end.
Yeah.
But have you got a sort of like core thing where you know that everybody loves that, but around the sort of side of that, you've got some slightly more exotic things when people go, do you know what, I fancy something a little bit different on a Friday.
Yeah, so, you know, again, this isn't something a consumer would necessarily see, but our menu is built around what we call core, stretch, and reward meals. Yeah. And that's in recognition of the fact that sometimes you want to spice things up a bit. So that dish in front of you, it's not beyond most people's ability to make it. But the thing is, you wouldn't make it during the week. Mm. You'd make it for the weekend because of the time required.
Yeah.
And so that would be example of a stretch meal.
Yeah, I see. So yes, completely understand that. Yeah. And in terms of ingredients and stuff, and your setup, I presume you have your own kitchen somewhere.
Yeah, in Northwest London. So couple things. On our site, you see that, you know, there's a philosophy on there that is really important to me. And you'll also find my numbers on there. And it's basically I ask any customer any problems, they call me directly. And it's always going to stay on there, no matter how large we become. And so everything that goes into our products can be found in the typical pantry in someone's home. Really important. So there's no junk. It's all natural. And again, on the site, you'll see if I wouldn't feed it to my kids, I'm not going to feed it to your kids.
Right.
And we're seeing more and more of a trend, and particularly in cities and particularly in London, where people aren't even using their kitchen at all. In fact, in some cases, I don't think they've even got kitchens, because they're either eating out or they're getting food takeaway, like this delivered. Yeah. Not takeaways though, Paul, but actual food like this that's being delivered.
But the trend
as well
started with a lot of people eating takeaway food, you know, from Just Eat or
there's
whatever.
More and more companies that can produce really good food for you and then come and deliver it. Yeah. I would imagine that if you really look at the cost of it, it's probably not that much more expensive than buying food in, you know, having your electricity bill, all the different
cooking
sorts of pots and pans, and all the food waste that goes with it because you didn't actually get around to manage to eat the thing on a Tuesday,
on
you know, that you thought you were going to
40% of what people buy, they throw away. Mm. One of the things about our meals as well is we have flat rate pricing. So meals for four you can get for £12, £14 or £16. See, what I looked to do is I wanted to flip the model on its head. I knew that if I took a chef, the typical chef, and I gave him £3 and I said, just make me something good, he'd do it. Mm. Because what a chef knows, every mum would love to know. Mm. And so I try to reflect that in the way that we do our meals. You know, these aren't complicated dishes, but I have the ability to buy on volume. I have the ability to reasonably mass produce and to deliver it in a pretty economical manner. So you would be hard pressed to go out and buy those ingredients yourself.
For £4 each.
And
essentially, make it. Amazing. But what do you think about this trend? And if you're saying that there's some millennials out there who do zero cooking, it's not going to get any better, is it? I know so many people are going to get used to or prefer, actually,
getting
their food in this way.
I think the market reacts. Mm. You know?
And as you say, is it a model anymore that you go to a huge supermarket that's massive with 25 different types of chili sauce, you know, and all that sort of stuff? You know, is that really viable for much longer?
Well, interesting that, because 20 years ago, the average family would shop on average about 72 times a year. Today, it's 250 times a year. From Kantar, very well-respected research company, what that says is people are shopping more often and buying less when they shop.
Yeah.
And in some of those weeks, a mom is shopping 7 times a week. The practicality of that for somebody who's so busy is just nuts. So the original question is, the market reacts.
Yeah.
So you're not going to, with God love Jamie Oliver, and I admire him greatly, people just are not going to pick up. Mm. They might pick up cooking as a hobby, But the practicality of the way people live today is during the week, it's hard to make a proper meal and get it to the table.
Especially when the old-fashioned ready meal with loads and loads of additives is actually almost being outlawed, isn't it? People don't want to be seen to be buying that stuff, and they don't want to buy that stuff. It doesn't even taste very nice.
Yeah.
And so there has to be an alternative to that.
Yeah, and there's a I've got a pretty decent team, and one of the people that's on my team is a product developer. She's developed 800 products for retail. And I asked, I said, well, do you need to make products the way they make them in a grocery store? And she said, no. Mm-hmm. It's just that, but when you've got a profit motive of 40% margin or more from the grocery retailer and then the company that sells that, you end up with very little that goes into the food. And so by actually eliminating the retailer from this model, it allows us to put more into the product.
Yeah, and there's great pressure, isn't there, on some of the supermarkets to say, you know, I want you to deliver me a family of four meal for 99p.
Yeah.
Which is just,
you know what you're going to get for that.
Ridiculously unrealistic. And yeah. What are you getting?
And you know what? With respect, this is where consumers have got to take responsibility.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, one of our things is we will not serve an abused animal ever. It's we just don't accept it. And the thing is, if you're paying 99p for a chicken, you've got to be smart enough to know where that chicken's coming from.
You know that it can barely walk and it's pumped through of antibiotics.
Absolutely.
And has led to the most miserable life you could
possibly
imagine.
You get what you pay for.
Yeah, absolutely. It is interesting, though, and that trend that you spotted is something that I spotted about myself. I'm a single boy these days and my kids have grown up and left home. But I shop 5 or 6 times a week and I shop for food for the evening that I'm going to cook it.
Or possibly the next day, and that's about it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a really weird thing, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know what? A lot of that has to do with planning. Mm. To plan in advance, to arrange the menu and the ingredients is a massive pain.
Yeah.
And people don't have time for that.
Yeah, absolutely. If we could just move on to other things, because I know you're very involved in the food industry and have been for a long time. What do you see the future of the kitchen? I mean, is there going to be kitchens in people's houses anymore, or is this sort of Internet of Things where it's going to be linked to? I mean, I've got an Alexa, which I love my Alexa. It's like my friend, and I come in at night and I go, Alexa, turn my living room lights on. You know, all the living room lights come on. You know, it's all really clever stuff. Can you see that going into the kitchen, or do you think a kitchen is going to be one of these unused places, which actually is about where you all meet as opposed to where you cook?
I mean, the most important room in a house psychologically is the kitchen. That's where we've gathered. That's where we've grown up. And gathering around the table is something that is part of our culture.
But do we cook there? That's interesting.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, when I started the research on this way back when, there's a correlation between property prices and the increase in convenience food businesses. Because the more expensive it is to live, the more people have to work. And what they end up with is no time but extra money. And they start to trade that off. So in answer to your original question, the reality is that I think that, you know, I was commissioned by a large company to study how much information is in the media that women are being exposed to around health. And diet is the number one category. And so when people are waking up and hearing today that their kids won't live as long because of obesity and that sort of thing, that's going to create a backlash. And so what we're going to find is companies are being pressured to produce better products. So now, the reality is we will probably find better products in the market, but we're not going to get more time back. So I think you're going to see more and more products like this, companies like mine, on the market to accommodate the new reality for people.
And do you think that the sort of gadget thing, therefore, is just a nice to have and something that's like toys as opposed to, you know, the kitchen's going to be revolutionized? I still think it's going to be a meeting place as opposed to somewhere where you prepare food.
Yeah,
it might be somewhere where you assemble food,
yeah, for sure.
For example.
I think actually product like Alexa or the new generation of smart appliances are going to feature services like these that simplify people being able to access food.
So it gives you a quicker route to market, so to speak. Almost.
Yeah, but you know, you are talking about a generation of people that have grown up with kitchen looking a certain way. It's going to be a long time before we're in Star Trek land, where you're just ordering it from a computer and it's just showing up.
Yeah, and in terms of you developing this stuff, what about the back end of it? Because like most food businesses, producing good food is a given. It has to be really, really good. Hmm. But actually setting up a business and then having the back end of that, all the processes, all the ordering, all the marketing, it is really, really important, because just running around somebody on a bicycle and delivering this is never going to be a business, is it? You're never going to make money or be successful.
No. You know, I'm fortunate. I have a business background. I've got a big team. And so I'm, You know, it's funny because I'm also a resident with Oxford University's Business School, and I'm specifically focused on entrepreneurship. And I go there and I talk to people about being an entrepreneur, and it's like there's days when it's not a lot of fun yeah. because the reason that you think there's a whole supply chain element, business. Right? Yeah. And at the end of the day, you've got to convince people to buy your product, and they've got lots of choices out there. You've got to deliver it profitably, which is tough, and you've got to make sure that all of the moving parts are functioning effectively to build that business. But I've got a great team, you know, and I'm committed to it. So
that's what you need. Yeah. Well, absolutely fascinating stuff, Robert. I'd like to talk much longer, but we've got a really nice section with Steve Keller, haven't we? So thank you very much. We're going to have to invite you back, I think, to see how it's all going in about a year's time.
Right.
See
Love
how
to.
You're doing. Yeah, that'd be really, really Thanks. Good. So thank you very much for joining us.
And I'm getting a waft of that food, and I'm starting to dribble.
You're getting hungry, yeah. Okay, so we're going to go over to Steve Keller, and this is the stuff around... We were talking about Valentine's Day, actually, and the link between music and food. And so let's hear from Steve.
Shall we have a hear?
Yeah.
Steve Keller. Here we go.
So I'm joined by Steve Keller, who is a music psychology expert, which sounds very, very interesting. We're going to learn all about that in a minute. It was Valentine's Day a couple of days ago. Steve, can I just ask, this is a private question, I suppose, did you do anything romantic on Valentine's Day?
Yes, I got some flowers for my beloved and a lot of little hearts and hid some things around the house with some cards.
So
and
very romantic then. Is that right?
Yes, I try to be as romantic as possible.
And are you a cook? Are you a chef at home at all in the kitchen? Any good?
I do love to cook, but when I cook, it's such an experience that I don't do it that often because I can't just make it simple.
Yeah. Okay. So you probably like my husband. He's very good at cooking, but he's not very good at clearing up. It's a complete mess. Now, when I go to, I'm just about to go to Portugal on holiday in a few weeks' time, and when I go to Portugal, you know, I can sit right on the, you know, on a harbour somewhere. I get an amazing plate of sardines. I get a glass of Vinho Verde, you know, that sparkling
yes.
young sort of green wine. And there's something about all the atmosphere and the mood and even the smells, I think, which makes that plate of food and that glass of wine taste amazing.
Yes.
Of course, I then go and buy that bottle of wine and think, I must take that home. I take it home and it's disgusting. I mean, really beyond disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
But there's definitely something around this experience at the time and this link with how you perceive food.
Yes.
And I'm guessing that your work is actually about music influencing your taste in food or the way that you perceive food and feel food and taste food at the time. Is that correct?
You're absolutely right. And what you just described is kind of what we would call a cross-modal experience. Charles Spence heads up the Cross-Modal Research Laboratory at Oxford, and I've spent a lot of time with Charles lately, and his research talks a lot about how all of our senses help us with an experience of reality. And so when we separate that experience from our senses, it's never quite the same, which is why when you have that bottle of wine at home without all those other sensory experiences that you had before, it doesn't taste the same. So wow. I focus specifically on sound and how sound impacts our taste.
So you've got 25 years of experience in the music industry mm-hmm. As a producer and a composer and a music publisher, but you've also got a degree in psychology. And I guess what you're trying to do is that you're merging your two bits of expertise of music and psychology and working out how that influences you. So for example, if I did buy some chocolates, you know, on Valentine's Day for my loved one, how could I make those chocolates taste even nicer by perhaps putting the right sort of music on?
Well, if we go back to your earlier description of the wine, and you talked about all of these factors that worked together, we found in research that the more congruent you make things or the better they fit, it kind of has an additive effect and makes the experience even more vibrant. So, for instance, if you were wanting to set a mood where it was a little more gentle or tender, you would probably want to use music that was maybe a little slower in tempo, a little bit moderated by melodies that weren't moving very quickly or dynamic. And then in terms of taste, you'd want to select a chocolate that might be creamier or have a caramel base. So if you were thinking of Cadbury, they're classic flavors of dairy milk, or the dairy milk caramel flavors would work. But let's say you wanted a little more excitement. So you'd want music that you would pick up the tempo. You'd have higher pitches that would be represented, maybe a little bit more complex harmonies. And then you'd move to the other end of the scale, maybe with a Cadbury jelly popping candy or crunchy bits. Just the names of those are kind of exciting. So if that's the kind of romantic experience you want with your loved one, that's the combination you'd want to have.
So we've had some really interesting chocolate makers on the show before, and one of my favorites, unashamedly, is 5D Chocolates, and they make a sort of ganache inside a chocolate coating. And they do have things like pink peppercorn flavors and, as you said, a sort of soy, salty, caramelly flavors. So if I was sort of gonna choose some amazing chocolate, you know, from wherever, I can actually look at perhaps the sort of music that might go with that, particularly towards the end of the evening. Say you've got chocolates at the end of the evening,
yes,
to maybe make things really smooth and calm, and that would accentuate that chocolate taste even more.
Exactly, and that's the amazing thing. You know, when we think about taste, we're not often thinking about sound, and sound is kind of the forgotten flavor, if you will, in our eating experience. And so, just by paying attention to that when you're eating a dish, can definitely change your perception of the flavor and enhance it.
And are restaurants using this at all at the moment, or any of the sort of fast food chains or anything? Because I've always sort of been told, I don't know if it's true, that quite often they'll put really sort of loud or jazzy music on, particularly in coffee shops, so you don't hang around too long, and also to make you hurry up and drink your coffee quickly and get out so they can get another person in your seat. But is anybody using music at all in the industry?
Well, certainly, you know, there's a whole movement now in cuisine called gastrophysics or neurogastronomy, where chefs are beginning to use this a lot more. Yosef Youssef from Kitchen Theory, or Heston Blumenthal from Fat Duck, use sounds a lot as part of an aspect of their dishes. But what you're describing in a lot of fast food restaurants are basically using sound and music behaviorally to move people in and out. But there's a danger in that, because as the volume increases and the tempo increases, the research has shown that the taste and the flavor actually decreases. And so a lot of restaurants aren't realizing that what they're actually doing is not simply changing the environment, but actually having an impact that could be negative on the flavor of the food, if they're concerned about the flavor.
If they are indeed concerned, yeah, I think you're right. So what you're saying then is that it can definitely affect your enjoyment of the food. It can can enhance it. Could it actually influence your decision on what you might choose, for example, on the menu?
It could. I think when you're starting to talk about decision making, that's a little bit more about associations. So sometimes there may be certain music or sounds that conjure up memories, and those memories can induce cravings as a result of that connection. So that's where the craving part of it would come in.
And is that just by sort of some sort of memory association? Is that?
Yes, typically that's definitely how that's working from a psychological perspective.
Good. So Steve, how on earth did you get into this area of research? I mean, it's quite niche, isn't it? It's quite unusual.
Yes, it is. Well, the short story is, you know, as you said earlier, my degree's in psychology. I was on my way to grad school and got sidetracked by music and wound up in Nashville, Music City, and spent a lot of time working on music there, and found that I had a love for advertising as a result of working on some commercials. And then in an aha moment, all three of these things came together, and and I was just fascinated with the power of sound to really shape perception and influence our behavior. And I've kind of pulled those three things together into to what I'm doing now.
And do you work for sort of brands and you know, sort of restaurant groups and stuff to try and help them in that respect, or is it just a research project?
No, I'm working a lot with brands. Cadbury, for instance, in the study that we did here, looked at the way that emotions and taste and sound had an impact. But I also engage in a lot of just interesting research on the side. Last year, I worked with Charles and a researcher from Oxford, Janice Wang, and we took a look at the relationship of sound to spiciness. Could we make a dish taste wow. spicier depending on what we were putting in your ears?
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yes, it really is.
Yeah. Brilliant. And is there anywhere that people can go, you know, if it's a sort of a topic that they're really interested, is there anywhere that they can go to find out more about it or more about your work?
Well, if they wanted to explore the work with Cadbury, they could go to the Sound of Cadbury Dairy Milk. Let me try again. This is a mouthful, like a mouthful of chocolate. Sound of Cadbury Dairy Milk. Spotify.co.uk.
Well, that is quite a mouthful. We'll make sure that we've got that on our website.
Great.
foodtalk.co.uk, and we'll have information on that. It's really going to change my perception, Steve, I think, that when I'm in a restaurant or when I go to somebody's home, I'm going to start taking notice of the music, really, and see if they've really thought this through about matching what I'm eating with music. I mean, I don't know what would happen if somebody came in and Prodigy was playing. I'm not quite sure what would you associate with that. But Mozart, maybe, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you a little diet tip. Some of the research has found that if you want to cut your caloric intake, eat with earplugs in.
Eat with earplugs in?
Yes.
So No
sound at all. You become kind of in tune with your own chewing, and it's not that it's that you're aggravated by that sound. It's more that you just become very mindful, and you just become aware of when you're full.
And you can hear yourself eating.
So up to 30% cut in your caloric intake.
Well, there's a top tip for all our listeners. If you want to, if you want to cut down on your calories a little bit, stick your earphones in. Probably not on Valentine's Day. That's bound to annoy your partner.
No, keep the earplugs out, eat the chocolate, and enjoy yourself.
Absolutely, Steve. It's a great pleasure to speak to you, and really, really interesting. And information on our website. Thank you, Steve Keller.
Thanks, Sue.
Wow, what a fascinating insight that was. Across modal references. Spice in your ears, and that diet tip at the end, wear earplugs when you're eating. What a fantastic interview that was. It really so insightful, and so many things going on there. Unbelievable. I'm still kind of trying to digest all of that and think about it and understand it. The psychology of music and food. Absolutely brilliant. So thanks to Steve Keller for that, music and food, especially around the Valentine's theme. I'd also like to say a huge thank you to our other guest today, Mr. Nigel Lloyd of the Soft Butter Company, or the Softer Butter Company, and also Robert Hocking of Independence Market. And I've got some fantastic Moroccan meatballs and couscous for my supper later on. But just to say a massive thank you for joining Sue and I on the Food Talk Show once again. We will be back next Thursday with another Food Talk Show. In the interim, you can catch up. You can listen to the podcast of this show. You can also listen to the podcasts of lots of our other shows, and you can find recipes, blogs, and all kinds of information by going to our website, which is thefoodtalkshow.co.uk, thefoodtalkshow.co.uk. Do have a listen for that. Do catch up with the podcast. But we'll be back with you next Thursday at 4 p.m. with another Food Talk Show. In the meantime, have a fabulous week, and we'll see you all soon.